Our fourth case for today is Adame against Holder. Ms. Bennett.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Jennifer Bennett, and I represent Mr. Adame, who's a 33-year-old male, native and citizen of Mexico. He's a hard-working man and a father of four. In brief summary, Mr. Adame was brought to the attention of Homeland Security in 2009. He was served a notice to appear and charged with being present in the United States without being admitted or paroled under INA Section 212. He appeared for an individual hearing.
But before you get too much further, the government's primary argument is that we lack jurisdiction over this petition for review because we can't revisit the factual findings that were made by first the immigration judge and then the board, and there really is no due process interest in a discretionary decision for cancellation of removal. So obviously we need to address jurisdiction first and foremost, and so I'd like to hear what you have to say about that.
Sure, Your Honor. We certainly understand that cancellation is a discretionary form of relief, and the court does not have jurisdiction to review that. However, we're not asking the court to make to review the factual determination about whether Mr. Adame meets the requirements for cancellation of removal.
But why not? I mean, it seems to me if we have to accept and it seems that the evidence is weak on, it's non-existent on Mr. Adame's part other than his own testimony, that he really has met the 10 years residency requirement. The evidence only goes back to 2001, which isn't far enough, the other evidence. And the immigration judge, I think, told him a number of times, look, you need more than just your word for it. If we can't revisit that, this case is over. He's not eligible.
We agree, Your Honor. To speak to that, I have 2 points. First of all, the judge did warn him, did give the warning on the record that it's not enough to just say that you've been here for 12 years. We believe that that's really subject to interpretation. One could easily interpret that as meaning that the judge was letting him know that there are more requirements than just to prove continuous presence, that you also have to prove the element of good moral character and hardship. So we think that's subject to interpretation. But also, again, we're not asking the court to actually review whether he meets the criteria. What we're asking, what we're challenging is the legal standard, the fact that we don't believe the immigration judge and the BIA, the Board of Immigration Appeals, in affirming the judge, applied the case law correctly, and particularly with respect to the 10 years, the judge and the BIA upheld that his testimony was not credible and therefore corroborating evidence was required.
But they're entitled to do that. I mean, I don't see a legal standard problem. I can certainly see that you wish that the judge had given more weight to Mr. Adame's word for it, and which is perfectly competent testimony, but on the other hand, you can see why the immigration judges might want something more than somebody coming in saying, I've been here for more than 10 years, because everybody would say that.
We understand that, Your Honor. And Section 240C, 4B, and C of the INA does in fact state that he must testify credibly, persuasively, and with specific facts, and that if he doesn't...
And he doesn't have the specific facts. He can't... He doesn't have so much as an affidavit from somebody from Kansas or, for that matter, Milwaukee, wherever he actually was in the period of time.
And that's correct, Your Honor. And that actually brings us to the real gut of our argument, which is we believe he was credible, but even if the judge required corroborating evidence, that's fine. He's supposed to provide it per the statute if it's readily available. However, in this case, it was not readily available.
But I was unpersuaded. I mean, you suggest a few things in your brief about why it wasn't readily available, but I don't get any sense from the brief that any effort was even made to track down some of the people that he lived with. Anything, you know, a receipt from a Walmart, you know, something.
Your Honor, we made substantial efforts with the client to track down that information. Unfortunately, the people that, for example, he testified regarding an employer from 16 years ago, the employer, we believe, is out of business. We tried to locate that employer. Even if the employer was in business, they wouldn't have records from 16 years ago.
Additionally, but does he remember nothing? He doesn't remember where he lived. He didn't have any neighbors. He didn't go to any church. He didn't.
He did actually testify specifically to the immigration judge that he lived with distant cousins. I don't recall the names, but I believe on the record he even listed the names of the cousins in Kansas City upon his arrival. And he then moved to Milwaukee, Wisconsin in 2001.
Were they unlawfully present in the country?
They were, Your Honor, I believe so. He also testified specifically as to the name of his employer. And keep in mind that
the employer was in Milwaukee. The judge or somebody says, or maybe it's the government's brief, says 900 miles. I mean, he wasn't like living in Kansas City and working for this Milwaukee employer.
I understand, Your Honor. Okay. I think it was difficult for him to remember the dates that far back upon his entry, and he did the best he could to remember. It's also important, I think, to keep in mind that he was his girlfriend, the mother of his newborn child, who was not yet born at the time of proceedings.
Right, this is child number 4. But see, in the light of all this fuzzy record, which is the best I can call it, the laws require us, even if we did have jurisdiction, and I'm not sure we do, to defer to the reasonable findings of the immigration judge and then, of course, the board if it speaks to an issue. And the board does speak to the 10-year issue. The board affirms the immigration judge's finding. I can't see anything that comes close to compelling us to rule the other way.
Again, Your Honor, we don't disagree. If the judge found his testimony to be uncredible on face value alone, that's okay. But the evidence was not available. His girlfriend, the mother of his to-be-born child, was undergoing a high-risk pregnancy with substantial complications. And we presented evidence in the form of a letter from her doctor to the
immigration judge. Whether he's been here for 10 years or not, whether he's here for 10 years or not, that's a fact. Either was or wasn't. But whether he has good moral character, that is not a fact. That's a judgment. What basis would we have for reversing that finding?
Well, Your Honor, the statute in the case law says that the judge must consider the evidence in the aggregate, the totality of the circumstances. They must
it's inherently very fuzzy, the concept of good moral character. And he has a number of arrests, and he had that cocaine charge mysteriously reduced to drinking in the park, right?
Correct.
Well, very
correct.
Strange, but I don't know. On what basis would we say no? He doesn't have bad moral character.
Well, I think on a number of bases.
What would the criteria be?
Sure, I think on a number of bases.
Compare him with the average American or something. Bottom 10% of Americans.
Their
number of arrests or what?
I think you have to weigh the equities, and there's a number of.
Well, let's look. You can say that, but what does it mean?
It means that we have to consider the positive factors. And in this case, he had a...
No, we're talking about his moral character, right?
Correct.
We're not talking about... Okay, what are the positive factors?
So the positive factors are that he's been involved in his community. He's been a hardworking individual. He cares for his 4 United States citizen children and their mother. He provides for them fully. His kids are doing well in school. Documentation was submitted to the judge showing that. And I see that I'm out of time.
Well, gangsters probably do the same thing, right? Their families.
Correct, Your Honor, but they don't always file taxes. They don't provide for their families. They don't work.
No.
They have more serious criminal offenses that result in them spending time in jail. And I see that I'm out of time.
You're in your rebuttal time.
Does he pay taxes?
You can answer.
He does, Your Honor. He testified that he's filed taxes for the last 9 years.
No, I understand he files a return. Does he owe taxes? Or is
he does not owe any tax money.
Pardon?
He does not owe any tax money.
No, bad debts, you're saying.
No bad debts.
Does he pay, is there a amount of money that goes to the U.S. government reflected on these tax returns?
Yes, Your Honor. As far as I know, there is. I looked at a couple of them. I have not. I can't say I've actually seen them all. But
okay. Thank you. You can save the rest of
Thank
your time.
You. Sure. Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Damiano?
May it please the Court, Lisa Damiano on behalf of the Attorney General. Good morning to you all. As Your Honor has mentioned, the primary issue in this case is whether the Court has jurisdiction over petitioner's claims.
Now, this Court has taken a pretty tough approach to that, tougher, say, than the Eighth Circuit does. Is there any reason why we have to be quite that rigid? Would this case come out differently if we adopted their approach?
Yes, Your Honor, we believe it would, and I feel...
So we'd grant the petition for review, or
the
bottom line would say petition for review denied as opposed to dismissed for want of jurisdiction?
The jurisdictional argument, Your Honor, I'm referring to whether this court would have jurisdiction may go a different direction in another circuit. And
why shouldn't we review non-discretionary decisions? We have all sorts of layers of deference anyway when we mm-hmm. review...
Well,
things.
The jurisdictional statute 1252A2B little I precludes jurisdiction over those discretionary forms of relief, including cancellation of removal. It only
unless there's the Part D, and what the Eighth Circuit
exactly.
thinks is if it's a non-discretionary decision,
right.
a mistake of law in applying, in coming to a non-discretionary conclusion is enough to squeeze you under the subpart D. language.
That's correct. The Eighth Circuit looks at it like in this type
but
of...
But that sounds as if every error is an error of law, right?
Well, the Eighth Circuit...
Every judgment is based on application of law to fact, so...
Again, and other circuits have interpreted that provision of the statute differently, and the Eighth Circuit says in this type of circumstance, they are reviewing the judge whether the judge applied the correct legal standard to the facts of the case. So they do see a legal question there, whereas this court has come down differently in its interpretation.
As I say, what that would mean was that every case would be reviewable because every case... legal decision.
Some circuits view it as a mixed question of law and fact. I know that that's a phrase that's thrown around in other circuits.
So do they in fact review every case, or are there a set of cases in which they say there is no, it's a pure fact issue with no legal dimension at all?
There are cases in which there's a pure factual issue, and I think Your Honor mentioned whether or not somebody has been here for 10 years may be a factual issue, but then a circuit like the Eighth Circuit would say, well, we're looking to see if the judge applied that continuous physical presence standard correctly to the facts of the case.
But there wouldn't be any dispute in some cases about whether...
Right.
That means there's only so much you can do to create a dispute. In fact, what about good moral character? Is that a pure legal issue, or is that a pure factual issue, or what?
Well, it depends on the jurisdiction, but it is a legal question when we're looking at the statutory grounds for good moral character, meaning there are grounds listed where you are not of good moral character if you fall into one of these
right.
categories.
Right. There's some things
right.
that certainly exclude good moral
right.
character. What if it's just a question about, you still can have good moral character if you have only 3 DUIs, but if you have 10 DUIs, then you're not of good moral character.
Well, we would argue that it would be under the catch-all discretionary good moral character finding, and that there would be no jurisdiction. But I feel
even in the Eighth Circuit, no.
Even in the Eighth Circuit, unless they have case law otherwise, but I don't believe they do. And I want to be candid with the court to let you know that we don't take this jurisdictional position in other circuits. We take this jurisdictional position in this case.
We are kind of an outlier, I believe, on this jurisdictional
yeah.
theory.
Yeah, so when petitioner raises the Sanchez-Velasco case in his opening brief, we just point out that that is a different circuit and that they have interpreted 1252A2B little I differently there than you have in this court. But even if there was jurisdiction, which we don't concede that there is jurisdiction, we feel that the that the agency did properly determine that his testimony alone was not sufficient to meet his burden of proof. Petitioner, you know, comes around and keeps raising the issue of corroboration. This was not a corroboration finding. This was not a credibility finding. This is simply the petitioner must demonstrate that he has met his burden of proof for removal. And he did not meet his burden of proof. And here you just have the agency weighing the evidence presented, and they determined that the evidence presented was not sufficient to meet the burden of proof to
so
show.
So where does the immigration judge actually make a finding about the availability of documentary evidence?
Well, Your Honor, we argue that we're looking at the board's decision in this case because they've independently reviewed the record.
But what's in the record? I mean, again, if there's zero, then their review isn't very good.
Well, in the board's decision, they reference that the testimony alone is not sufficient, and in a footnote, they indicate that there's this testimony, but then there's the documentary evidence that seems to conflict. The 2001 traffic ticket lists a different address than his asylum.
Right, there's some inconsistencies in later evidence. Is there ever a finding about the availability of documentary evidence from the 1997-98 time?
No, there's no. I mean, the judge mentions, and so does the board, in fact, mentions that, you know, that this particular petitioner did not obtain statements from people he knew or his cousins. He didn't.
There's just an assumption they'd be available, even if they were undocumented aliens. It's not crazy to think that they would not want to really make themselves available for a government proceeding. They would be looking at a notice to appear tomorrow.
That's true, Your Honor. It's not unreasonable to think somebody undocumented would not want to make a statement. However, Petitioner's counsel just conceded that she believes those people were documented. But whether
well,
or
I
not
thought she said no.
Oh, I thought she said that. But whether or not they were, Petitioner lists in his application that he worked for a Milwaukee employer beginning in December 1997. Now, that was a number of years ago, but we're talking about back in 2009 when this petitioner was in proceedings.
Has anybody Googled them to see if they're still around?
I have not personally Googled okay. them, Your Honor. But again, the judge did not make a corroboration finding, simply said he could have tried to obtain this other evidence. He did not tell the judge, I'm sorry, Your Honor, I couldn't get this evidence. He simply had 2 years to present all of the evidence he could find, and he was unable to come up with any evidence from 1997 to 2001 time frame. And then the evidence he did present was conflicting. He has the traffic ticket that says he lives on Military Road. That address conflicts with his application, which says he lives on Trail Road. And that evidence conflicts with his employment record, which he himself gave to the court, which says that he was in Milwaukee from 1997 on working for Ramon Cleaning. So, you know, at the forefront, we argue that the court lacks jurisdiction because this is a factual finding and that the petitioner has not presented a question of law. But even if the court has jurisdiction, he simply has not presented enough to show he met the continuous physical presence. And I just want to mention also that the good moral character and hardship findings are not before the court because the board explicitly declined to adopt the judge's finding and base the decision on the dispositive determination that he did not show continuous physical presence. Regarding the due process claims, we feel that he can't challenge the denial of cancellation of removal because he doesn't have a liberty or property interest in discretionary relief such as cancellation. And I don't believe petitioner has argued otherwise. And just as in this court's Sevilla case, he does have a potential liberty interest in remaining in this country. But even if he is successful on the continuous physical presence prong, he still has to go back and prove hardship. And that's an ultimately discretionary finding. So he does not have a substantive entitlement from which to base his due process claim.
Under the government's current policy, would he be removed today?
Yes, he would. That would be based. The timing would be based on the eligibility of travel documents and travel arrangements and such. you know, if you're referring to prosecutorial discretion,
yes.
I'm not aware that this petitioner has approached Department of Homeland Security to request prosecution.
But doesn't he fall into the current policy approach with regard to non-felons?
Well, it's not simply just non-felons. We look for, not we, but the agencies, Department of Homeland Security, look for a set of criteria to see if a particular non-citizen fits into those criteria. And this case has not been identified as one where the agency is willing to exercise prosecutorial discretion.
Is that because he hasn't applied for it, or...
Well, there are no. That's not because the agency. I see. I'm out of time. If I
may. I'm sure the chief will allow you to respond.
Thank you. Yes, just because a petitioner doesn't ask for prosecutorial discretion doesn't mean that the case won't be identified independently. And in fact, our office and Department of Homeland Security identifies a lot of cases. This one is not, the case was not such that we identified it. It's not.
Why would this not be under the criteria that exist for the current administration policy be identified as such?
Well, I would be speculating. I would have to ask Department of Homeland Security, and I can certainly look into it and ask them.
Well, no, I mean,
back.
What is the role of the Justice Department in this identification process?
Well, the identification can come from our office, or the identification can come from the agencies themselves. But there is a list of kind of criteria on the memo, the Morton memo, and, you know, in this case, I mean, again, it hasn't been reviewed by the department, but just being in the United States for a certain amount of time and not having a felony isn't necessarily enough.
Yeah, I guess I'm just interested in how this is all playing out. So, you know, obviously, we've got this case. And, you've come out here on behalf of the department. I just wonder, is there some contemporaneous review of cases like this while you're out here arguing?
Yes, there is. When a case is assigned to an argument, when the case is assigned to an attorney in my office, the attorney reviews the case at the onset. They review it when the petition for review is filed, and then it's transferred to another attorney at briefing, and that attorney also reviews the case. And if they feel that the case clearly falls within something the agency would want to see remanded for prosecutorial discretion, we approach the client agencies and we give them all the information and say, how would you feel about this? Sometimes the agencies come to us because they learn of some intervening event, like the person is approved for a U visa, or they now have an approved I-130 family petition, something that we might not be aware of because we're working with a stale record, but they have that information. So sometimes they come to us, but even if they don't, the attorneys assigned to the case review the case. And we certainly do approach client agencies when we feel.
So that I understand this, the fact that you're here on this case means the review has not happened yet, or it's happened and the decision has been made that this isn't an appropriate case?
The decision has been made by the attorneys in my office that the case wasn't appropriate to go back to the agencies with. But the agencies can come to us at any time, like I said, if they learn of some intervening event in this.
How does that occur? Does the petitioner have to go to the agents?
If the petitioner learns of something new in their own lives that might help them get some sort of relief, and they're not a felon, and they have good moral character, not statutory good moral character, but they have what they believe to be good moral character, they can approach the agency at any time to prompt that review. Sometimes the agency learns of an event and contacts our office, such as, like I said, the approval of a U visa or some sort of visa or petition that might otherwise give them an opportunity to remain in the United States.
Thank you.
Do you have any other questions?
No more questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anything further? Ms. Bennett.
Your
Your Honor, I think, Your Honors, I think that the court understands that the jurisdiction is a unique issue, and that the Seventh Circuit, I think, as you indicated, is a outlier. And that I would just like to bring to the court's attention the case Raphael versus Mukasey, in which moral character and hardship did come before this court. The court did determine, it was a cancellation case also, and this court did determine that there was jurisdiction because the immigration judge made a legal error in understanding the definition or the term, the meaning of the term, exceptional and extremely unusual hardship. So I would just like to bring that case to the court's attention. And that's in the Seventh Circuit, not the Eighth Circuit. I know there was a lot of discussion about that. And I think that's all, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.